This morning comes from Mark 16, 1 through 8, and Colossians 3, 1 through 4. Mark 16, 1 through 8 says, "When the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene, Mary, the mother of James, and Salome bought spices so that they might go to anoint Jesus' body. Very early on the first day of the week, just after sunrise, they were on their way to the tomb, and they asked each other, 'Who will roll the stone away from the entrance of the tomb?' But when they looked up, they saw that the stone, which was very large, had been rolled away. As they entered the tomb, they saw a young man dressed in a white robe sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed. 'Don't be alarmed,' he said. 'You are looking for Jesus the Nazarene who was crucified. He has risen. He is not here. See the place where they laid him? But go. Tell his disciples and Peter, he is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him just as he told you.' Trembling and bewildered, the women went out and fled from the tomb. They said nothing to anyone because they were afraid." And Colossians says, "Since then you have been raised with Christ, set your hearts on things above, where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God. Set your minds on things above, not on earthly things. For you died, and your life is now hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is your life, appears, then you will also appear with him in glory."
It's always nice to have the Easter, the church full on Easter. We don't get to see us all together except probably this one time, and I am just thankful for this opportunity to preach this morning, because, you know, sometimes when we come to speaking on the resurrection, it's like, what more can be said? Where do we go with this? But really, every Sunday we gather is a celebration of this Easter event. And we mark this one time per year to remember that, but really it is a part of our life every day. And if nothing else, our gathering this morning is a reminder of that, to live as people of the resurrection and to consider these things. Now, my sermon this morning begins with one thought, really. It's this idea that, and I think I've expressed this in various ways in other sermons, but it's this idea that we have been gifted by God with this this wonderful instrument, and it rests between our two eyes, and it's called the brain. Significantly, we have this. Specifically, we have this region called the cerebral cortex, and that's the part of our brain that thinks and analyzes and imagines. It's this place also, as I've noted in previous sermons, I believe, stories are formed, and stories are important. The gift of the imaginative storytelling is, in our human life, both a blessing and a curse, depending on what kind of stories we tell ourselves, what kind of stories we choose to cultivate. Is it a life-giving story, or is it a death-giving story? Is it a forward-moving story, a hopeful story, or is it a despairing story? We create these stories that give life, and we gravitate to stories sometimes that don't lead to life. And resurrection is a story that should be our story. In fact, my thesis this morning suggests that we live and die by the stories we tell ourselves. Theologians call these big stories meta-narratives, stories that shape and inform us in how we view the world and thus respond within the context of our own specific, what we call smaller stories, personal stories. And these big stories map out how we imagine the world and in return guide us in how we behave and act in this world. Now, all religious traditions have some kind of meta-narratives around which they organize. But the central narrative of the Christian faith is formed in the narrative of the resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth. To clarify, let me say that the term resurrection from a Christian perspective is the idea that Jesus, after being tried and convicted and crucified and laid to rest in a tomb, was after 3 days dead, raised to a new life, and appeared physically to the disciples and others before being taken up into heaven. A matter of legend to some, a matter of history to others. You decide. Whatever was made of the event of Jesus' life, the story of resurrection is told in all 4 Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And when a story is repeated in all 4 versions of the Gospels, it says something that is central about this story that requires our attention. Something extraordinary occurred. And the fact that all 4 Gospels tell the story is based in basically the same way, yet with recollection of differing details, is further evidence to me of the authenticity of these stories. Mark is the oldest of the Gospels. In the earliest intact manuscripts, it ends with verse 8. And I know in many of your Bibles you have, it continues on, but the earliest intact records of Matthew's gospel actually end abruptly at verse 8. The women who discover the empty tomb, it says, were afraid and told no one. And that's where it ends. Now, I like this earliest version because it leaves the story open-ended for me. As if to say, now you, the listener, go and finish this story. You take ownership of this story and you run with it. Continue to take this story and extend it out into the world. That's what I like about that version. Now, Matthew gives us the post-resurrection marching orders, where Jesus' last words on this earth are, go out into the world and make disciples, teaching them all I have commanded you. But then there's Luke. Now, Luke has a little different portion of this story. Luke tells how the resurrected Jesus opened the minds of the disciples in the breaking of the bread while on the road to Emmaus. Jesus is seen and known in the coming together of conversation and in the breaking of the bread. That's the special piece that Luke gives us. Now, John seems to want us to know that the resurrection was physical. The physicality of the post-resurrected, crucified Jesus is important to John's telling. In John's gospel, the disciple Thomas, upon hearing that Jesus is alive, must first touch the wounds before he can believe. Later in John's gospel, Jesus appears by the lake shore and sits down to eat fish with his friends, as if to say, mere ghosts or spiritual concepts do not eat fish and break bread. Every Easter Sunday, I preach this central resurrection narrative of the Christian tradition. And every Easter Sunday, I recognize that the congregation consists of a broad spectrum of beliefs regarding this story. To some, the story is purely metaphysical or metaphorical. To others, including the Apostle Paul, it makes no sense unless it is historically and literally true. Now, in saying this, I recognize the fact that people come in different places to how they relate to the Jesus story. I'm fond of a poem written by the poet Denise Levertov, and the poem is entitled On Belief in the Physical Resurrection of Jesus. I will read this. She says, it is for all, literalists of the imagination, poets or not, that miracle is possible and essential. Are some intricate minds nourished on concept as epiphytes flourish in the high canopy? Can they subsist on the light, on the half metaphor that's not grounded in dust, grit, heavy carnal clay? Do signs contain and utter for them all the reality that they need? Resurrection for some an internal power, but not a matter of flesh. For others, of whom I am one, miracles, ultimate need, bread of life, are miracles just because people so tuned to the humdrum laws, gravity, mortality, can't open to symbol's power unless convinced of its ground, its roots in bone and blood. They must feel the pulse in the wound to believe that with God all things are possible. Taste bread at Emmaus that warm hands broke and blessed. Now for myself, I choose on most days to be in Levertov's camp. But whether one believes in resurrection as metaphor or as historical reality that points to metaphor, the issue still is one of meaning. It's the big cosmic so what. Regardless of where one falls on the question of literal historicalness, one is still required to ask the question personally. So what does it mean? What are the implications? How does Jesus rising from the dead make a difference? I suppose I state the absurdly obvious if I say that all of us are here this morning because we are alive. That said, many of us, of course, in our mortal bodies have aches and pains, and all of us have challenges that we suffer with. And I know some of you have had close brushes with death through circumstances of illness and accident. When I, too, experienced one of those near-death stories, as I've shared with you before, I had the opportunity to consider a new way of looking at the story of Christ's resurrection. At Sacred Heart Hospital, a Catholic hospital in Spokane, in every room is an icon of the resurrected Jesus, transcendently resurrected upon the cross. Not crucified, but resurrected. Now, as a Christian, I've always felt that this was a powerful visual image of the ultimate symbol of life, the victory of life over death. The message, Jesus is alive. Death is powerless before the power of life, death is powerless before the power of life. And to me, the message is clear. God is not mocked, and life is not defeated by any cruelty we human beings may cast upon others. But none of this translated to me while I was in the hospital. The central symbol of my faith did not speak to me when you might think it would speak the loudest. But then when I think back on that experience, I think everything was pretty flat and speechless. I had little or no interest in food. People brought me books to read and would read to me, but I had no interest. Everything on TV was absurd. You know, in the TV room or in the hospital, they just want to distract you as much as they can. Every other channel was some story involving a gun or explosion or fear and tension and conflict. It didn't strike me so much when I was healthy, but when I was sick, it was like, wow, that's crazy. Or there were channels dedicated to some silly reality shows where people were constantly competing and squabbling on some family of hillbillies who sell duck calls were discussing the best way to blow up a beaver dam. This all seemed so empty and absurd to me. And I guess it was. But then when I couldn't imagine the resurrection, or when it did not bring me comfort as a theological image or a biblical image, it did come to me. And it came to me in the care and love of my family who were there in the midst of this crisis in profound ways. It came in the form of prayers and gestures and mindfulness of many, many friends, including members at this church. through you and your good thoughts and prayers, God was there in profound and mysterious ways. Resurrection came in the nurses and the doctors and the technicians and the chaplains and the caring folks who focused their best skills and energy toward keeping this one privileged middle-aged white guy alive on this planet for a few more decades. The resurrection came to me through all this love and care that I experienced. We don't have to be in a medical or existential crisis to realize that the story of the resurrection is a powerful narrative. This narrative declares to the world that the very force of the cosmos is within, is before, is around, and is much bigger than we are. Yet it is a part of us. Resurrection calls out and calls us back again. Resurrection never lets death and suffering have the last word. Jesus lived it, Jesus taught it, and Jesus proved it. That's why we celebrate this morning. Resurrection is a powerful thing, and that is why Jesus didn't stay on the cross. That is why the tomb is empty. That is why the angels say, go and find him. He is risen. Most summers I work with Mennonite youth in the Northwest Mennonite camps. Last summer I was at Drift Creek, and previous summers I've been at Camrac in Washington. At one of the campfire talks a number of years ago, I shared how... I remember how Roger, who was the camp director, manager at the time, he had a really, really good quality telescope. And with some help from his phone's app, Roger was able to zero in the one little viewfinder, two separate spiraling galaxies visible through this one lens. Now, these galaxies, we are told, contain billions of stars and planets. I reminded the kids at that the nearest spiraling galaxy is the Andromeda Galaxy, which is 3 million light years away. Furthermore, there are reported to be billions of these galaxies within the known universe. Furthermore, there are thought to be multiple dimensions of realities we cannot perceive. And as if this were not enough to grab our attention and strike our hearts with awe, it is said that only 4% of the matter of the universe is perceivable, leaving 96% to be labeled something called dark matter, which cannot be directly perceived. In light of these and other modern observations and theories of science, it would seem that the resurrection of Christ might not be such a hard thing to believe. My point of considering the vast and mysterious universe we live in to these junior high kids at summer camp, as well as to you this morning, is to get us to believe and to celebrate and to find courage in the reality that we are a part of a very, very large and mysterious God-ruled, God-centered story. The story of the Christian tradition is one of mystery and victorious power of love and life. It is one of life over death. It is one of hope and the embrace of a God who cannot be defeated and will not let go, ever. And how, you may ask, can one judge whether one's story or narrative is one of resurrection? You may consider this. Resurrection stories are always about hope and never about fear. Resurrection stories are about thriving and not just about surviving. They are about sharing as opposed to accumulating and consuming. Resurrection stories are always about creativity and risk-taking. When you hear stories about cooperation, unity, compassion, and tolerance, you are hearing echoes that point to the resurrection. Resurrection always defies the world's tired, old, dysfunctional stories of win, lose, dog eat dog, us versus them, and everyone for themselves. When you read the Gospels through the lens of resurrection, you begin to see the world through the lens that God sees the world. I recently listened to someone whom I know and respect relate to me a story from her work. She was working in a year-long volunteer program, kind of like voluntary service program. And was asking her, and I put this in quotes, the person she was volunteering for, the employer, with whom, she was a volunteer, She asked for a little flex time for one afternoon a week in order to do some more hands-on work related to her vocational pursuits, because her volunteer work was supposed to be related to her vocational interests, but it turned out she was more or less a glorified secretary, and she was an unglorified secretary, and so she was looking to do some other more hands-on things that related to her interests. Well, her boss, who had already displayed little respect or appreciation in her management style, said in response to this modest request, "That's not how things work in the real world." Now, to that banal reply, I say, as one who believes in the truth of the resurrection, phooey. Much of what we call the real world is a construct of our own making. Resurrection says other worlds are possible. Other ways of relating to this world are possible. Stories of the devil are often the ones that resign us to believe, well, that's just the way the world works. As one who identifies as a pastor, as a husband, as a father, and most fundamentally as a human being who has the privilege of taking up some time and space on this planet, I'll tell you about the real world that I experience. I live in a world of inconsistencies and context and nuance and paradox and mystery, and yes, hypocrisy and sin. Nevertheless, this is the real world I live in. And the only effective and honest and humble way I can move through this world is trusting in the victory and the power and the grace of the resurrection story. There is no room for fear and pettiness in this resurrection story. In God's story, the only one that ultimately counts, resurrection rules. A friend of mine was facing a long engagement with cancer, and I'm sure many of you have had similar engagements. And please forgive me if I recite this poem and you've heard it and you're kind of tired of it, but when I first heard it, I was touched by it. To me, it's powerful. Powerful, and it relates to the theme this morning of the resurrection. But instead of using the word cancer, I will say it using inserting the word crucifixion. Crucifixion is so limited. It cannot cripple love. It cannot shatter hope. It cannot corrode faith. It cannot destroy peace. It cannot kill friendships. It cannot suppress memories. It cannot invade the soul. It cannot steal eternal life. It cannot conquer the spirit. Crucifixion is so limited. That's the message of the cross. If there is any message to be taken away, may it be the message that informs us that death, be it spiritual death or literal death, is never, never the last word. Life, God, is always the last word. Amen.